Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Welcome to Overnight America with Ryan Recker on KMOX. Sponsored by Michaels Flooring, the flooring experts. MichaelsFlooringOutlet.com.
And welcome to Overnight America. Wow, it's the last show of the week. And yeah, things get a little bit weird on the last show. But we feel pretty good. It felt right to hear the Cardinals celebrating back in 2011, get to relive that moment, knowing they went from 10.5 games back to make it, and this historic run has been fun. It's comforting knowing that before baseball gets back, at least we have some sort of normal in our life that is enjoying baseball on the radio. So it's fun to be led into by Cardinals baseball, and we got a big show planned for you tonight. And joining us right off the bat is author of a new book called How to Make Love to a Despot, Dr. Steven Krasner. Thank you so much for coming on to KMOX.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, this book just came out a few weeks ago. It's getting some pretty good reviews. I'm looking at it, and I'm looking at some of the things people are saying about it. It looks like it's selling pretty well. And you're a prominent scholar, and I wanted to get and learn a little bit more about you. What is your background?
So basically, I've taught it at UCLA and Harvard, and I've been at Stanford for a long time. I have worked in government, so I was the director of policy planning from 2005 to 2007 when Condoleezza Rice was the Secretary of State. I worked at the NSC before that on the Millennium Challenge account, and when I was a very young person, I spent 2 years in the Peace Corps in northern Nigeria from 1963 to 1965.
Yeah.
So I have been around a bit.
And the subtitle to your book.
But I've been around a bit.
Yeah. Well, the subtitle to your book, An Alternative Foreign Policy for the 21st Century, which is interesting. Are you saying a lot of times our foreign policy is not up to date?
Well, I think most of the time we tried to do too much. I mean, it's very obvious now if you look at Afghanistan, Iraq, even Vietnam, if you go a little further back, that we attempted to make these places just like us and basically failed. We were very successful with Germany and Japan after the Second World War, I think for very peculiar reasons, and not necessarily because the people that were governing in Japan were committed to democracy. So what I'm thinking is that we really need something which we have to think of the world as, we have to think of a foreign policy which would get places to someplace in between Denmark, which is a rich, consolidated democracy, in Somalia, which is basically a country which is falling apart. Mm-hmm. And that's not easy for Americans, I don't think, because we like to think of ourselves as being idealistic, as promoting our ideals. I think in many places, promoting our ideals is not the best policy that we could follow.
You know, what's interesting is, you know, with a title like How to Make Love to a Despot, and you talk about some of these other countries and how we've handled them in the past and foreign policy, it almost sounds like as a government or our world leaders need to like wine and dine other countries in order to get them on board. Is that kind of the feel?
So I say that, you know, if I were to rewrite the title now, which of course is too late to do, I would say how to hold hands with a despot rather than how to make love to a despot. But I do think that if we're looking at, you know, most of the countries in the world are basically autocratic, say 130 out of 200. If you look at the number of countries that have enriched consolidated democracies, perhaps there are 30, 35 in the world. They're concentrated in North America, Western Europe, and East Asia. They've only been around for about 100 or 150 years, so it's pretty amazing. most people have lived most of the time in most places in the world. They've been under autocratic governments, which have not necessarily ruled justly, but have ruled in the interests of the ruling elite. And I think the problem is that the notion that everybody's going to be just like us, that consolidated democracy is a natural order of things that are just three places alone, that's what they're going to evolve. And I think that's basically false. Mm. On the other hand, I think that we're threatened by, well, obviously by COVID-19, which is just the beginning. And I have to say we're kind of lucky that COVID-19 had a relatively low mortality rate. But people could artificially generate pathogens that could be much more lethal than COVID-19. It's hard to get nuclear weapons, but not impossible. So relatively weak states or even non-state actors could kill millions of Americans. So we can't ignore the rest of the world, but we also cannot make the rest of the world just like us.
Mm-hmm. You know what's interesting, and we've started to see an uptick in this way of thinking. So for a long time, very few Republicans would talk about this, but you'd have the Rand Pauls of the world that would stand up and say, do we really need to be involved in all these other countries, right? So if we're involved in 20 different places, can't we just cut that back to, I don't know, 10 and then use that money somewhere else? And now you're starting to see during the Trump administration that way of thinking. We've been spending money in the Middle East forever. We're not getting results. We're not going to convince them. We're not changing anything, you know, but then again, it takes you 10 years to fix a pothole, and we have our schools are falling apart and our bridges. So maybe it's time we start pulling some of that foreign money back. And I think you talked a little bit about that when it comes to foreign money.
Well,
I'd love to get your thoughts.
I think it's right to say that we can't remake the world in our own image. I think it's wrong to say, though, that the rest of the world doesn't threaten us. If we look at COVID-19, this is only the first. It will happen again. It will definitely happen again. And it could be worse than what we've already experienced. And it will happen because there are more and more humans on beings on Earth, that most of the new diseases are diseases that jump from animals to human beings. As we get more human beings, they're encroaching on animal environments more and more. So COVID-19 is only the first. So that I don't think we can totally ignore the rest of the world, which is, I think, basically what the Trump administration is saying. On the other hand, I don't think we can make the rest of the world into consolidated democracies, which is what the Bush administration wanted, and which is kind of a part of traditional American foreign policy. So I think we can aim for some things in other parts of the world. Good enough governance, not good governance. We can aim for security. We can aim for better health, because I think that is something that the elites in all parts of the world want, and it strengthens our own position. And we can get some economic growth, but provided that the economic growth doesn't threaten the local elites, because if it does, they'll simply frustrate it.
Mm. Do you mind holding on after the break? I want to talk to you about some of the places you think we're effectively handling other countries and when it comes to our foreign policies, and then some places you think have been failures. Can we talk about that after the break?
Happy to do that.
All right, so the book is out now, and you can find it on Amazon and other places. Dr. Stephen Krasner, How to Make Love to a Despot. And by the way, is there a website you'd prefer someone to go to?
No. So I think you can find my, I do have a website at Stanford University, but I think Amazon is the best place to buy the book, especially since everything else is closed. Right.
Yeah. Well, that's it. You know, the local bookstores, we normally would say go and patronize your local bookstores. But in a time like this, everyone's getting their books ordered to them and they're always looking for things. You have a Kindle version. There's audio. People do enjoy listening to the audio side of it, and the hardcover book you can find on Amazon.
Right.
How to Make Love to a Despot. Just go to Amazon and look for it there. We're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Stephen Krasner next on Overnight America, KMOX.
KMOX is St. Louis's news, talk, sports, radio.
Thank you for hanging out with us here tonight on Overnight America. We do this online, too, through the radio.com app. You can follow me on the Ryan Recker Radio Facebook page, and we'll post this up on the podcast as well. Our interview now with Dr. Stephen Krasner and his new book called How to Make Love to a Despot. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, and we look at foreign policy, and we have been spending a lot of time, I guess, paying attention to it because during this administration, there's a lot of emphasis put onto it between countries like North Korea and China. Some of them are allies with Japan and South Korea, and then our relations with other large organizations, the World Health Organization, the United Nations, things like that. I want to look at the United States as a whole in some of the periods you look at. What are some of those foreign policy failures and successes that you cover in your book?
So I think we had tremendous success in Germany and Japan after the Second World War. But it wasn't because, I mean, if you look at the Emperor Hirohito, he could have been tried for a war criminal as well, as opposed to allying himself with MacArthur. I think basically the Japanese elite had been discredited after the war. They weren't particularly interested in democracy, but they saw the alternative to alliance with the United States is being even worse. That is, having a communist regime which would completely displace the old aristocracy that had existed in Japan. So I think we got a democratic Japan over the long run, not because people were necessarily committed to democracy, but because they thought ties with the U.S. were the best way that they could go. If you look at South Korea, South Korea is actually the only large country that's gone from being poor and autocratic to being rich and democratic in the period since 1945. And at least part of that was a result of the assistance that was provided by the United States. I think we also did very well in Colombia. Under Plan Colombia, we actually got the place to a degree of stability. We defeated the FARC, which is a left-wing guerrilla movement. We did pretty well. But I think in all of those places, we do well if our objectives are more modest than our objectives have been. If you look at Iraq, Afghanistan, we attempted to make these countries into democracies. They weren't going to be democracies. We wanted to have free and fair elections. You're not going to have free and fair elections in these places. You wanted to get rid of all corruption. We weren't going to get rid of all corruption because these countries basically run through corruption. That's the way the elites get their revenue. So I think if you're looking at corruption, we'd be better off, rather than trying to eliminate corruption, thinking about patronage as opposed to gross theft and moving the money out of the country, which is something that happened in Afghanistan under Karzai when he was president, when he loaned about $800 million from the Bank of Kabul. We'd be better off thinking about more modest objectives, more stability, but we can't ignore these countries entirely because they could be a threat to us. I mean, either as a result of nuclear weapons or as a result of pandemics.
Yeah, and it's interesting because that's the way we've looked at it in the past and trying to sell it to the American people. So the stability of certain regions, it's worth our investment, it's worth our time, it's worth our resources when it comes to the military. If you were to overall look at the success rate the United States has had working with some other countries, because you mentioned some that have turned out well, but there's also some that have not turned out so well, would you say that's a good success rate, a par, or actually a pretty poor success rate?
No, I mean, I think our success rate on the whole, you'd have to say, has been, well, at least not good. There are lots of places where we failed. I mean, Afghanistan, Iraq, it's very obvious that we spent a lot of money, and we can't say that we got a lot for it. Now, I think in those places, we would have been better off if we thought about stability and we thought about improvement in health, which is something that's been a big success story since the Second World War. If we thought about some improvement in economic growth, that's what I mean by good enough governance. But we shouldn't think that we could transform these countries. I think that's been our big problem, that some of these countries are maybe receptive to American ideals, but some of them may not be receptive at all. And that political elites in these countries will be able to frustrate what we do unless we get them on our side. So the basic bottom line of my book is no success unless you have the support of local elites. And most of those local elites are fundamentally autocratic and corrupt. Mm-hmm. And we have to learn how to get along with them, not just think that we can turn them into being just like us.
Wow. In your book, How to Make Love to a Despot, people can look it up online on Amazon. Dr. Stephen Krasner joining us. And I'm wondering what you look at as maybe one of our biggest modern mistakes when it comes to foreign policy.
So I think if you're looking at Afghanistan, so look, I do think that we have to intervene in Afghanistan after 9/11. In fact, I was in Washington working at the State Department when 9/11 took place. But the idea that we could transform Afghanistan so that we could have something like human, you know, everybody would have human rights, so that we'd have free and fair elections, so we'd be able to eliminate corruption, I think that was a huge mistake. We should have recognized that Afghanistan is basically a backward country. It's extremely poor. We might be able to improve education. We might be able to get girls educated through primary school, but we're not going to end up in a situation where Afghanistan is going to look just like the United States. So we spent a lot of money in Afghanistan, and a lot of it, I think, was fundamentally something that failed. And it failed because our objectives were too ambitious.
You know, when you say too ambitious, does the United States often too ambitious, or do you feel like they have a pretty good understanding of what is necessary before they get into some of these foreign policy implications?
So I think it's very hard to get to understand what's going on in other countries. Very hard. I mean, I was, as I said, in the Peace Corps in northern Nigeria in the early 1960s. About 6 months after I left, they killed all the southern Nigerians that lived in the town where I was at, posted. I absolutely did not see that coming. I think the problem is that foreigners have every interest in getting lots of money from the U.S. The people that often get these money are people that speak English well, that know exactly what Americans want to hear. It doesn't necessarily mean that political elites will be committed to our ideals. So I think, you know, I don't want to say, I mean, the American government is very big, and I think there are people that are really smart, and they spend a lot of time understanding countries. But figuring out what's going on in other places is really very difficult, especially if you're the president or the secretary of state or some major political figure. It's very difficult to understand what's going on in these other places. What we should recognize that is that in most places, the best that we can hope for is good enough governance, not good government.
Wow. You know, it makes it sound like we have a difficult time sniffing out corruption in some of these areas, as in we really have a hard time trying to get a good profile of the people that would be in charge. And when you start to realize that a lot of these countries are corrupt, but we still find a way to get involved with them, there's a lot of trust involved. But at the same time, it's like you're always watching them. You're sleeping with one eye open. Is there a way to even safeguard yourself against corruption?
Thinking about corruption, I think the problem is that we won't be able to eliminate corruption entirely. Why won't we be able to eliminate it? Because autocratic elites get a lot of money and political support through corruption. But I think what we should aim for is having a kind of corruption where the money at least stays within the country, which would be what you have if you have clientelism and patronage. And something that I think is really bad is if all the money gets, you know, for instance, in Afghanistan, when you steal all the money, you ship it out of the country to Dubai, for instance. So I think that we understand that corruption is there, but the notion that we can eliminate corruption entirely is where I think we get ourselves into trouble. And I think we'd be much smarter if we thought about corruption as something. There are better kinds of corruptions and worse kinds of corruption. And it's better to have the money stay in the country than to have the money get shipped out of the country.
Very good. So again, the book, How to Make Love to a Despot, if people wanted to look it up, you said best opportunity now is to go on to Amazon?
Yes, I think the best place to do would be to go to Amazon.
That's great. I got to say, it's been a real pleasure to have you on the show tonight. You're very knowledgeable on all of this, and I've learned a lot hearing from you, and I think people would learn a lot too if they checked out your book.
Okay,
and I got to say,
so much for
thank
having
you.
Me.
Dr. Stephen Krasner, and the author of How to Make Love to a Despot. Make sure to look it up on Amazon. He joins us on the TDK Technologies guest line. Wow, super informative. Super informative. I think we need those type of conversations so we're able to digest news in a way where we're not just getting the catchy headline. And you might read the first paragraph, and then you have no idea after that, and you just inform all your thoughts on that little bit. No. There's so much more that goes into it. He's got so many great bits of information he just told us in this past half hour of this interview. I got to say, he was great. All right, we're going to continue, and a lot to do on the show tonight. In fact, there was one thing that was brought up today during the task force briefing at the White House that I think is huge news that you need to know about. We'll talk about that next on Overnight America KMOX.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odyssey podcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odyssey podcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/odyssey podcast.
Now back to Overnight America on KMOX, sponsored by Michaels Flooring, the flooring experts, michaelsflooringoutlet.com.
Hey, thanks for joining us on Overnight America. Wow. I hope that tonight goes by quick. Why? Because I always like a night where we get interaction, where we get to talk to you. One of the nice things that Jim White really encouraged on his show was that he wanted people to call in with their opinions, but you wanted to call in with an opinion that is an opinion. You know, you just don't go in and you start name calling or whatever. I would love it. You just say, good night, just done. You'd be done. And you think about the way things have gone for the last month. I've been broadcasting from my basement here for the past month. It's hard to believe, honestly, for me that it's gone by this quickly. But I got to say, in the past month, I think we've had more caller interaction than in what we saw in the previous months and leading up to it. There's so many people right now that are leaving the radio on in their home. They're turning to KMOX. They keep it there for new information, but when it comes to the nighttime hours, we're able to digest that and have conversations about it. And in the spirit of Jim White, we get to keep those conversations going, and I've been loving it, enjoying it. It's so strange to sit here in my basement, in my home, surrounded by moving blankets that I secured to the rafters of the ceiling here in the basement. And I know my wife and my son are upstairs, my wife getting ready to sleep, my son's sleeping, and I'm talking to people all across the United States, and they're talking to me, and all of these things could happen simultaneously. It's really amazing to me. So just real quick, if you haven't already liked the Facebook page, go to Ryan Recker Radio on Facebook. You can see it on there. I want to keep the phone lines open, so if you have something you want to say, give us a call. On Thursdays, we try to stay flexible. So if there's something that comes to mind, something we may have missed this week, something you didn't have a chance to call in on, this is your opportunity to do it. What we don't want you to do is sit around the next couple of days thinking, oh, I wish I would have said this. You know when that happens to me? When I'm in the shower. This apparently is a common thing. You're standing there and you're doing your thing and you're cleaning yourself, and then you think in your mind, oh, I wish I would have said that. Right? That happens to other people. I'm sure it does. Oh, I wish I would have said that to this person. Oh, this would have been a good comeback. Oh, I would have loved it if I would have brought this up this way. I can't be the only one that has that happen to them. So this is your opportunity, so you don't have to have those moments. You can just get it out now. 314-436-7900 or 800-925-1120. So during the press conference from today, hey, how about this? In Missouri, we got a shout-out. Yeah, Vice President Pence mentioned Governor Parson.
For instance, Governor Mike Parson of Missouri announced the Show Me Strong Recovery Plan has two initial phases intended to protect the most at risk. Governor Tom Wolf announced the plan for Pennsylvania that would begin May 8th will end a stay-at-home order for just portions of Pennsylvania. But the plan, again, requires regions to have fewer than 50 new positive cases per 100,000 for a period of 14 days. And it also lays out a phased reopening roadmap. Governor Kate Brown of Oregon updated their framework for reopening, doing three phases, again, on a county-by-county basis. And Governor Brad Little of Idaho released Rebound Idaho in just the last few days that will consist of four phases and require specific criteria that Idaho and businesses need to meet to begin to reopen.
All right, so just going through some of the game plans for states that are getting ready or at least preparing with a plan for their people. Here in Missouri, it's a little bit different because we have a St. Louis, a city and county, we have a Kansas City, and we have these areas that are not ready for reopening, and you have the leaders of those areas. So here it's Mayor Lyda Crewson and Dr. Sam Page that are saying we need to hold out. We're not ready to open by May 4th. We don't think it's there yet. The governor is going to continue to put that order through. But since it's tighter restrictions here locally, that supersedes it. So local areas are able to implement their own tighter restrictions above and beyond what the governor's order is, which means even though most of the state will be opening up on May 4th, and you may be in one of those areas, you may be down in Franklin County and getting ready to go out and enjoy eating at your favorite restaurant, or some of these businesses are ready to open the doors again. It's not going to be like that everywhere in our listening area. Some places it'll be okay, and other places it won't. You just won't be able to do that in the city and county just yet. In Illinois, you have Governor Pritzker saying it's not until the end of May before the restrictions start to get lifted. I mean, they're not looking out weeks ahead. They're looking out, you know, a month ahead and then plus some. But I wanted to bring this one thing up. During the press conference earlier today, the White House task force brought up in person from Homeland Security. I think he works in technologies in Homeland Security. His name is William Bryan. And I posted this photo up on the Facebook page, Ryan Recker Radio, if you haven't seen it. This is amazing. So this started back in February with Homeland Security. So anyone listening right now that calls in and criticizes the way that this administration has handled the virus, and they say, oh, they haven't done anything, and, you know, they waited too long, and you can have your criticisms, but let me point out this real quick. Back in February, not only were they talking about stopping travel between China and then eventually Europe, other than United States citizens, they're blocking travel. There's something else that was going on, too. They're studying this virus. So Homeland Security, as he explained as part of this press conference, was isolating this virus as they found out it could be quite dangerous. And they were finding out, how do we combat it? How do we stop it? How do we break it down? What's the things that are going to be most effective? And this is back in February, Homeland Security was starting this. We were already working on a vaccine and treatment, and they were already studying these things. I mean, immediately. This is before we started to have the stay-at-home orders, or at least here in the United States. Because, I mean, think about it this way. What good would it have done knowing and trying to sell it to the American people that we just don't have the cases showing up like we have in these other countries, but we're going to react like these other countries are reacting? It'd almost be like here in the state of Missouri, if Governor Parson said, well, you know, a wide majority of these counties are not having issues, but St. Louis County is and St. Louis City is. So we're just going to keep the entire state closed down. But, you know, these other places that really have no problem and they're able to combat this effectively, we're just going to be dictated based on what these areas are doing. So that's why I think it's smart that each governor has the discretion. They could open it up county by county if they feel that's easier. If there's some counties or some cities that are having a hard time, you keep it closed down longer. And then they're relying on the local healthcare network and all of the hospitals that are reporting this data so they're not overloading them. It's a personalized touch that a lot of governors are doing, including here in Missouri. But, you know, it was too early back in February to do something, but it doesn't mean the United States was doing nothing at all. And as described here as part of their research, they're now just showing and releasing some of their findings of how this virus reacts to UV sunlight. For the longest time, people were mocking it and saying, oh, we don't know. This is on the light end. We don't know if sunlight will be effective. We don't know if this will go away in the summer. This COVID-19, you know, this strain of it, we just don't know because it could react like other viruses, but probably not. It's a whole different thing. And a lot of people said that you were being, I'm using this in the lightest terms possible because there was a lot worse that was said during this time, but you're being overly optimistic that this could go away during the summer. Little did we know in the background, Homeland Security, they've been studying this for months. What's going to happen? How effective it is with UV sunlight hitting these viruses? And they presented the findings today, which were extremely, extremely encouraging. Let me play this from William Bryan of Homeland Security.
Within the conditions we've tested to date, the virus in droplets of saliva survives best in indoors and dry conditions. The virus does not survive as well in droplets of saliva, and that's important because a lot of testing being done is not necessarily being done, number one, with the COVID-19 virus, and number two, in saliva or respiratory fluids. And thirdly, the virus dies the quickest in the presence of direct sunlight under these conditions. And when you look at that chart, look at the aerosol as you breathe it. You put it in a room, 70 to 75 degrees, 20% humidity, low humidity. It lasts, the half-life is about an hour. But you get outside and it cuts down to a minute and a half. Very significant difference. Wow. when it gets hit with UV rays.
Isn't that something? So let's look at a surface and say that between the temperatures of 70 and 75 degrees with about 80% humidity in the summer versus 20% humidity, which would be no direct sunlight, okay? So inside a house versus outside the house. Inside the house, if you have 70 to 75 degrees, 20% humidity with no direct sunlight, the half-life for the virus would be 18 hours. And they decide to study the half-life because they wanted to study how the virus breaks down and becomes less effective, or the way it deteriorates and starts to eventually go away. So you can test and see, all right, is it present? But really what they want to look at is how effective it's going to be and how does it break down and how long does it take for it to break down. So on a surface inside a house, for example, 70 to 75 degrees with 20% humidity, it lasts 18 hours. The half-life is every 18 hours it breaks down at half effective. You can just put it that way. It's, you know, then if you go outside with about 70 to 75 degrees with 80% humidity, we're talking about outside and sunlight, it goes from 18 hour half-life from indoors to 2 minutes. 2 minutes. That's a huge difference. Look at it in aerosol too, in spray. 20% humidity, let's say indoors with 70 to 75 degree temperatures, it's about 60 minutes half-life, you know, with the spray. Outside in the summer where you have the direct sunlight, same temperature, 70 to 75 degrees, it goes from 60 minutes drops to a minute and a half before a half-life. Isn't that amazing? So we're going from, on the one end, 18 hours it could linger and live on surfaces. But if you go outside in direct sunlight under the same conditions with higher humidity, that could drop down to, you know, a matter of minutes or hours. We're not 18 hours, but, you know, 2 minutes in some cases. Isn't that just so fascinating? So the way that they've studied this is to say, not that this is going to give us a security blanket per se, but the whole idea, the concept of this is to say we know more about the virus now. This will help us better inform our decisions moving into the summer, knowing what we know. And it may also help inform some individuals thinking, okay, I could clean and clean and clean in my house. But maybe after all, the best thing to do is to get a little sunlight on these old bones. 314-436-7900 is the number, or 800-925-1120. I have some more clips and questions because there was a lot of questions about this. William Bryan answered some of them on the findings. I just think it's great. This is very encouraging news. Some people are downplaying it, and you'll hear their reaction to it. I think you just have to take it into context of how this is going to be effectively used. But to me, this is such encouraging news. This is Overnight America, KMOX.
Now back to Overnight America on KMOX. Sponsored by Michaels Flooring, the flooring experts. MichaelsFlooringOutlet.com.
And Overnight America's live right now. Until it's not live. You know, we do the replay sometimes because through the overnight hours. So depending on when you're listening to us, you always have that opportunity to connect. If it's not live on Facebook, it's a great way to do it. Ryan Recker Radio. Just look us up in... You can find it there. You know what's interesting? I got a message on Facebook just a minute ago from Grant, and we messaged back and forth, and he sends me just notes here and there, and he mentioned one thing. He said, do you remember that guest you had on a few weeks ago? He said, humidity kills viruses like this. Isn't that interesting? Because now the reports are coming out and they're saying that high humidity combined with UV rays are things that are very effective at killing this virus in a way of at least killing it and the dropping the half-life down. The guy was on, man. Isn't that something? He was right on. And it was something he brought to us. He said it was a world exclusive. You were his first interview where he was talking about it. 314-436-7900. I may have to try to find a way to pull that clip out and play it again because he seemed to be a little bit ahead of what the news today was out of the White House press briefing. They had a gentleman by the name of William Bryan from Homeland Security that was talking about the virus's half-life and how this virus breaks down in different conditions that help it break down quicker, including going outdoors. There were some questions on those findings.
Thank you. When you started your presentation, you described this as an emerging result. Does this mean your study is conclusive? Is there more work to do?
We're continuing that. For example, on the aerosol side, you notice the figures were 20% humidity. We're looking at higher humidity levels. We would expect that we even have a greater impact on the virus. We're looking at other types of disinfectants. And so as a scientific community, we're continuing to study the virus to understand its characteristics.
Mr. Bryan, can you explain why some hot spots we've seen in the U.S. are hot and humid, like New Orleans, for example?
Let me explain. If you look at the coronavirus as a chain with many links, what we've done through our study is we've identified some of the weak links in that chain that the virus, the transmission of the virus depends upon. We identified that heat and humidity is a weakness in that chain. We've identified that sunlight, solar light, UV rays is a weakness in that chain. That doesn't take away the other activities, the guidance from the White House, the guidance from the CDC and others on the actions and steps that people need to take to protect themselves. This is just another tool in our tool belt, right? Another weapon in the fight that we can add to it. And in the summer, we know that summer-like conditions are going to create an environment where the transmission can be decreased. And that's an opportunity for us to get ahead.
This is an opportunity for us to take this data, knowing what we know, and use it as a way to combat this thing. This is good. This is a good step. And we got maybe a few minutes here before we go to CBS News. I would love to talk to you, really. This is the thing on Thursday nights. I want to hear from you. 314-436-7900. All right, so how is this data going to be used?
How should governors who are opening their states, working on that, incorporate the findings of this study into those guidelines?
I would leave that up to the governors. This is a decision. This factors into their decision process. As I mentioned, with knowing this knowledge and having this knowledge, as we continue to study and further know what the virus does and how it reacts, it could impact the way a governor will look at what he opens in a state, how he opens it, in what environments these things are opened up. But I leave that up to the governors to make that decision.
Obviously, at the moment, the advice is stay at home. By the summer, could we be flipping that and saying you'd be much better off being outside with UV rays, all the humidity that Washington brings in August?
I would not go contrary to the guidance that have been issued right now. I think, though, to tell you that if I'm having an event with my family, I'm doing it in the driveway or in the backyard, not inside the house with my children.
In fact, I'm thinking about moving outside to the Rose Garden. No, it's a very interesting question, actually.
Okay. Yeah, just let's move everything out Rose Garden. All right, let's get out in the sun, let them sweat a little. It's probably not a bad idea. And what the thing was, he said, this is a guy that's been researching this. He's at Homeland Security. He is someone that has been on the front watching this, probably with a lab coat and safety goggles. That seems like the type of place that would require those sort of things. Who knows? Maybe there's even other special precautions in place that he gets to see a front row seat to the way that this virus starts to break down and what causes it to break down. And when the guy that is on the front line watching this thing and what's most effective says, you know, if I'm gonna get a gathering this summer, I'm doing it outside. That's a pretty important thing. Now, something else he mentioned about the outdoor things, he said, so think about a playground. And if you are in the city, the playgrounds and the parks are still open. If you're in the county, they're not. Hopefully that changes. And hopefully this new bit of information could help, you know, grease the wheels a little bit to changing it. But if you are out in the playground, think about where the sun hits these playground equipment, you know, pretty much on the sides, on top, everything like that. So if you are a carrier and don't know it of the coronavirus and you're at a playground and you touch something and you leave the virus on something that you touch with these UV lights and rays on a nice, warm, humid summer day or whatever it is, it would start the half-life process in a matter of minutes, which eventually would minimize a lot of the risk of you catching it. It doesn't mean you don't wash your hands. It doesn't mean you don't socially distance from getting it directly. It doesn't mean any of those things. He also said that if the sun doesn't shine there, not as a insult, but let's say on the underside. So when you have these playgrounds and there's different levels and layers and you climb or whatever it is, in some of these areas underneath them just don't get direct sunlight. It's shady. It doesn't have the same effect. You got to have the direct UV sunlight. That's where you have a more of a chance of this thing sticking around longer. It's really fascinating. So on your clothes, on yourself, whatever it may be, still use the same precautions that you would. Still use soap and water. Still use hand sanitizer. Still socially distance. Still keep in mind, you know, the idea of mitigation, which is you kind of separating from and trying to minimize the risks of what other people could do to spread this to you. You want to keep in mind it's also a risk going out at any time. But at some point, you got to realize going outside of your house is a risk. And it's always been a risk. What do you do to keep yourself safe from this? And some of these tips that they're giving are going to be super effective. And now we know, thank goodness, that the summer could be a huge companion of ours when it comes to fighting this thing. I want to take some of your calls. I want to get some of your thoughts coming up. And I want to do a Overnight America poll coming up, too. Don't go anywhere. It's Overnight America, KMOX.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.